This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. It's hot out. Right now, the Northeast is suffering through record high temperatures. A new book, Heatwave, A Social Autopsy of Disaster in Chicago, looks back at the summer of 1995, when, according to author Eric Kleinenberg, 739 people died of heat-related causes in one blistering week. To put this in context, he points out that the Great Chicago Fire of 1871 killed half that many, the San Francisco earthquake of 1989 killed 62, and Hurricane Andrew killed 26. Kleinenberg says that we don't generally think of heat waves as natural disasters or serious public health hazards, but we should. An assistant professor of sociology at New York University, Kleinenberg decided to conduct a social autopsy when weather scientists couldn't account for the high death toll in Chicago that summer. Though it wasn't the longest heat wave ever in the city, the weather was extreme.
The roads buckled. There were problems with train rails. The power went out for 200,000 people in the city over the course of the week. 50,000 people suffered a loss of power when one substation alone went out. In the poor neighborhoods in Chicago where there weren't many publicly air-conditioned places, residents opened up the fire hydrants, and 3,000 fire hydrants were opened during the weekend. At one point, several communities on the south side lost their water pressure, so there were places in Chicago that had no energy and no water during this period of intense and dangerous heat.
How many days did it take before the city saw its first deaths from the heat, and how fast did the casualties mount once they started?
Among the first deaths in Chicago were two toddlers who were being cared for at a home daycare center where the woman providing the service had taken 8 or 10 children out in a van to go to an air-conditioned movie theater and get a quick bite to eat. And when she brought the children in, she forgot about two of them and left them in the car where the temperatures quickly spiked to 160 or 170 degrees. And those first two deaths presaged what the city was about to see. On a typical day in July of Chicago, about 72 people die. This week, the death toll spiked incredibly. On one day, there were about 350 deaths, another more than 200. In all for the week, medical researchers now know that there were 739 people in excess of the norm who died in Chicago. It was a death toll that, like nothing the city had ever seen.
Apparently, the morgue in Chicago ran out of bays to put the bodies. How did the city deal with the body count?
Well, the fast-thinking medical examiner at Donahue realized he needed lots of assistance to store the bodies. He put out a call to the owner of a refrigerated truck company, and this man was willing to send some vehicles into the morgue. At first, he sent two or three, and quickly they filled up, and he sent more, and they filled up as well. By the end of the week, there were 9, or according to one report, 10, 48-foot-long refrigerated meatpacking trucks right in the center of the city storing the bodies that the morgue couldn't handle. And you can imagine this is a kind of surreal scene in a city like Chicago, the famous meatpacking city of Upton Sinclair. And here we had this kind of, you know, return of the repressed in American life in dramatic fashion. So many dead bodies in the center of the city that almost no one could make sense of what had happened.
Yeah, you know, this is really horrific, and I don't even know how to phrase this. I'm sure the horrible irony of this isn't lost on you, that these people who died of excessive heat were then stored in refrigerated trucks to preserve their corpses.
No, it's something I say in Heatwave, that one of the sad aspects of the story is that people got the kind of attention that would have saved their lives, artificial cooling and a care of public service workers only after they died. You know, one of the points that I make in the book is that Chicago and the nation more generally has had real trouble coming to terms with what happened here during that week. And in part, I think it's because the stories we tell ourselves about what happened in American cities in the 1990s don't fit well with the story of Chicago in 1995. Chicago was in the midst of a period of great prosperity, a major economic boom and revitalization. The streets were coming to life. There were new trees and planters everywhere you looked. There was a kind of jubilant rhetoric about the turnaround that the city had, and it was preparing for the National Democratic Convention, which would come to kind of restore the reputation of Chicago. And suddenly we see these dozens and then hundreds of deaths right in the heart of Chicago, and these bodies get delivered to the morgue, literally just a few miles from the Loop.
I think at one point the city buried 68 people during this crisis in a trench. Is this right?
That's right. About a month after July, there were so many unclaimed bodies in Chicago that the county had to deal with the remains. And as they typically do, they brought in a truck and moved the bodies to a cemetery of a suburb on the south side. And their cemetery workers dug a trench that was about 160 feet long and 10 feet wide and buried 68 people, 41 of whom were heat victims and 27 of whom were people who just died around the city and had no one come to claim their bodies. And they were buried together in the end. When I show this image to people for the first time, they typically think it's a shot of Bosnia or El Salvador in the 1980s, some faraway war zone, a world that's totally different from our own. And when I tell them it's Chicago, and more than that, Chicago during this period of great prosperity, they find it hard to believe.
It's interesting, when you interviewed Chicago residents later, after about a month after the heat wave, they had the impression that only about 100 people died. And when I talked to people around town here, do you remember, 1995 in Chicago? They had that same impression. Do you think this is because of denial or bad memory, or the fact that we distrust the media to report numbers, or what? How do you explain it?
Well, it's some combination of all of those things. From the moment that the heat hit the city, the collective and particularly the political response to the disaster has been marked by denial of what happened. If you think about the contrast here between the story of the heat wave in Chicago and other American disasters, it's pretty revealing. In other circumstances, we all know that local officials are exceedingly quick to declare an official emergency or disaster, in part so they can get federal assistance funds and call attention to what's happening in their town. In Chicago, the opposite process was at work. When the medical examiner began to issue his death reports, the mayor of the city, Richard Daley, immediately told reporters not to blow the week out of proportion, and he questioned the scientific legitimacy of the medical examiner's findings. This sparked a political and scientific controversy in the city, one that local journalists quickly picked up into this scandalous debate over whether the deaths were really real or whether they had somehow been fabricated by the medical examiner himself.
I think there's some other things at work here, too, though. Isn't it that people don't really consider heat a disaster because you can't really see it? There are no really big pictures on TV that, for instance, when there's a hurricane, you see evidence of the disaster. It's such a silent, invisible death that so many of these people suffered.
I think you're right. It's not easy to picture a heat wave if you close your eyes and try to imagine what a hurricane or a tornado or a flood looks like. Images come very quickly to your mind.
And TV cameras can glom onto them. I mean, they can put things on TV.
Absolutely. I say we all carry stock photos of those disasters in our minds because we've seen them so many times on television or on the front pages of our newspapers. But heat waves don't make good television, and they don't make good news graphics most of the time. They're these invisible killers, as you said. And so we're somewhat skeptical about them. And I think the other thing, in contrast to the other disasters we've described, is that for many people, heat waves are very easy to manage. You go to your office or to your home and you turn the button on your air conditioner and suddenly everything is okay. Heat waves are less universal disasters. They pinpoint the vulnerable and poor people who can't defend themselves. And I think for many of us, that's hard to understand.
I'm speaking with Eric Kleinenberg. He's an assistant professor of sociology at New York University. His new book is Heat Wave, A Social Autopsy of Disaster in Chicago. We're going to take a break now, Eric, and then we'll talk some more.
Okay.
This is Fresh Air. Back with my guest, sociologist Eric Kleinenberg. His new book about a disaster which claimed the lives of more than 700 people in Chicago in the summer of 1995 is called Heat Wave. What are some of the factors that you considered in looking at how isolated these elderly people were who died alone? And I'm thinking, when I hear about these heat waves and I hear about these elderly people found dead at home with the windows shut, yeah. I think, how did that happen? Did they not have the strength to open their windows, or were they afraid that they'd get robbed if they did open their windows? How did this happen?
Well, I think the association between the high neighborhood crime levels and the high death rate provides part of your answer, that people who live in areas where they know that they're more likely to be victims of crime are themselves interested in providing kind of makeshift security systems, since they typically can't afford to have expensive, private home alarms. They'll do things like have neighbors or relatives come and seal shut their windows, or in some cases nail shut the windows, really safeguarding the apartment. They'll lock or sometimes double lock their doors. Sometimes they're skeptical when someone knocks and looks in on them, part because they're worried that it could be a predator of some kind. And when they're living in neighborhoods with high crime and violence, they become more likely to shut themselves in and use this kind of reclusion as a safety strategy.
You read police reports of these deaths. What struck you about those?
There's a short and crisp and brutal language that we use to make sense of death. Sometimes it's clinical if it comes from medical researchers or a medical examiner. Sometimes it's just more curt and social, like when it comes from a police officer doing an investigation. I was able to track down the police reports from a number of people who died that week. I found one, for example, that simply listed the following items: female, age 73, white, July 17th, 1995. A recluse for 10 years, never left apartment. Found today by son, apparently DOA. Conditions in apartment when responding officers arrived: thermostat was registering over 90 degrees Fahrenheit with no air circulation except for windows opened by sun after death. Possible heat-related death. Had a known heart problem 10 years ago, but never completed medication or treatment. And that was it. There were dozens of accounts like this, and they left me with a kind of partial sense of the stories of these people, this kind of secret society of people who lived and died alone, but I was not satisfied by it. I felt as if there was much more to say when there's so many hundreds of people who die and die alone in a booming city. That's something we need to understand outside of the medical vocabulary or the vocabulary of the police report.
You also went through the boxes holding the personal effects of people who had died alone during the heat wave and who had no one to claim their things. Were you trying to get a sense of who they were?
I was, exactly. It was almost impossible to understand what happens to people who die alone and are out of contact with the world around them. you obviously can't speak with them. By definition, there weren't other people watching them, spending time with them as they perished. And so there are no last-minute accounts that you can get in most cases. And so I felt through much of the process of writing this book that there was a story I couldn't quite get at. And then I learned about the public administrator's office that investigates these cases where people die and have no one to come and claim the body or the estate. And I got in touch with the office in Chicago, and they invited me to come in and look at the files that remained. They had done about 170 investigations during the week of the heat wave. That means that there were at least 170 people who died alone and then had no one come to claim them until an investigation started. And by the time I got there, there were about 60 completed files of cases that had still never been claimed. And an administrative officer picked up a box, and the assistant picked up another one or two, and they put them in a small room and left me there with them. And suddenly, after years of trying to understand this event, I was face to face with the personal effects of dozens of the victims. I started opening the envelopes and came across watches and wallets, personal letters, photographs from the room. In one case, I found this file of a man who had been a decorated war veteran who had won a Bronze Star and had a certificate for his contributions in war, and a photograph of him as a young soldier sat just a few feet from the place where he died alone. And I think one disturbing experience, you know, based on this, or the kind of knowledge from this, is the sense that at one point someone could be so successful, so socially integrated, so alive and connected, and not long after be found dead and alone in an American city.
Now, part of your book is an indictment of how the city of Chicago responded to the crisis in 1995. What were some of the city's massive failures?
The public health emergency programs in Chicago were completely overwhelmed during the week. There were thousands of calls for emergency medical care, for paramedics, and the fire department, which manages emergency medical care in Chicago, was so overwhelmed that their response times were delayed. In many cases, it took more than 30 minutes to reach someone. In at least one case, the wait was over 70 minutes. And the ambulances were extraordinarily busy, so much so that the department was using fire trucks to respond to emergency calls. Now, there are several paramedics in Chicago who reported to me that they made specific requests to higher-ups in the department for more ambulances and for more paramedic staff, but had their request turned down. They felt like they weren't being taken seriously by the administration. And you can see this through the city's response to the mounting disaster in several levels. There was no capacity to coordinate the emergency health system, for example. At one point, 18 different emergency rooms in Chicago closed their doors to new patients. They went on bypass status, and 23 hospitals in the city, almost half in Chicago, closed. And there was no administration of this. There was no one putting it all together from above. The city has a famous community policing program, one that's designed to have officers on the streets getting to know residents, providing special kinds of support and care. And yet, no one activated the officers who are in charge of providing for seniors doing this community work during the week. And in part, I think the problem was that there was no leadership from above issuing an emergency that would trigger a sense of danger in all of the departments. The responsibilities were so diffuse that no one could see what was happening. The event unfolded as a series of isolated and segmented problems, in part because city governments have become so segmented. And in this case, I think that segmentation made it difficult to recognize what happened in the city.
Eric Kleinenberg's new book is Heatwave, A Social Autopsy of Disaster in Chicago. We'll continue our conversation in the second half of the show. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Let's continue our interview with Eric Kleinenberg. His new book, Heatwave, examines one sweltering week in 1995 in Chicago when 739 people died. Chicago and other cities are looking at what went wrong that summer in order to better protect vulnerable citizens from the heat. Now, there are some simple solutions to excessive heat that we've had since the mid-20th century. You turn on an air conditioner, and of course, you have to have an air conditioner, and you have to be able to afford the electricity for it if you do have it. But these aren't really insurmountable problems for a city government, are they? I mean, if you have an emergency response team and people are knocking on doors trying to see if there are people home alone in danger of heat exhaustion, that they could reach these people and do something. How do air conditioners and air conditioning fit into this whole mess?
Well, heat is very easy to combat if you have an air conditioner and if you can afford the energy to use it. Some people think that providing air conditioners to more people in cities would make for a good public health solution. As expensive as it would be, it would be a fraction of the cost that we spend to react to other major disasters. Of course, we'd also need to provide guarantees for summer energy the way that we do for winter heat. Collectively, we've recognized that it is cruel and inhumane to leave Americans without heat in the winter. But we don't have that same sensibility about summer heat. We don't provide cooling. So perhaps that's an area that we could investigate more seriously collectively, particularly now that we know that heat waves do kill more Americans than all of these other disasters combined. There are some other things that city governments can do to protect residents from the dangers of summer heat. And in fact, Chicago does most of them now. For example, there's a heat weather warning system developed by a geographer, Lawrence Kochstein, in Delaware that many cities use, including Philadelphia. And the system is able to distinguish between truly dangerous summer weather and ordinary heat. And when cities use it, they can oftentimes predict a dangerous climate long before it arrives. Once they do, there are a number of steps cities can take to trigger these emergency programs. You mentioned cooling centers, and cities can open them, but they have to make sure that the people who would use them can get there, and so it's important to have special public transportation programs set up. In order to recognize who's at risk, cities also need to be aware about this emerging population of people who are old and poor and living alone during normal times. In Chicago today, the local government does quite a lot to keep track of who is vulnerable in the city. They have names and addresses and phone numbers. And when there's extreme summer weather, city workers and volunteers go to the heat command center and make phone calls checking up on people who are at risk. The community police officers and other city workers actually do go door to door sometimes. And the city is quick to call local media and urge them to make public warnings.
There's an energy issue here, though, while we're talking about cooling and air conditioners. And one of the problems Chicago had in 1995 and all major cities have during these heat waves is blackouts and rolling blackouts. And I understand also in Chicago that the heat itself overwhelmed their technology, that the system kind of burnt up.
There were so many people using air conditioning in Chicago that the power grids broke down and the energy systems literally burst into flames. here there's another story to tell about the politics of air conditioners. We're currently engaged in some major discussions at the federal level about the standards we should hold air conditioning makers to when they produce their units. We can produce more energy efficient air conditioning units with a grade of 13 that limits the amount of energy that they demand when they're in use. In fact, that was a standard that President Clinton set. But when President Bush came into office, he lowered that standard from 13 to 12. And although it might appear to be a somewhat innocuous decision, in fact, that means that when city residents use those air conditioners, they'll need more energy. And in order to provide the energy, there'll be more utilities companies building more plants. And until that happens, there'll probably be more cities having electrical shortages and people both paying more for their energy and also being more vulnerable to power outages.
How well do you think major cities in the country are prepared for heat waves now? Have they learned from the example of Chicago and the past, heat waves in the past?
I think that some have. Philadelphia, Boston, Chicago, St. Louis, Milwaukee, there are some cities that have experienced extreme heat waves themselves or have learned from Chicago and are now trying to do something about it. But my sense is that for the most part, it remains a kind of invisible crisis in the United States today, that it's not a matter of national significance. And for example, we haven't had congressional hearings about the dangers of summer weather. As far as I know, there are no major federal reports that urge cities to implement a series of public health protection strategies. And my sense is it's still somewhat off the radar screen. Clearly, what happened in Chicago in 1995 signaled a warning to many public health experts and city leaders. But was the warning strong enough? I don't know.
Eric Kleinenberg, thanks very much for talking with me today on Fresh Air.
Thanks for having me.
Eric Kleinenberg's new book is Heat Wave. This is Fresh Air.